You've been listening to 93.3 WNRB Wausau. Real life, real learning, real radio. Coming up next, a show the NSA always loves to listen into and stop tapping my phones. This is The Mike Cannon Show.
Warning, the views expressed on The Mike Cannon Show, or the segments brought to you on this indie media radio show do not necessarily reflect the views of WNRB nor WNRB's host.
This is my boomstick!
The Mike Cannon Show.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
Hello, and thanks once again for tuning in to this alternative, non-corporately controlled indie media radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. Each week we bring you alternative voices from around our country and the world. Reports and shows from other not-for-profit and or community radio stations like this WNRB station you're listening to now. When you listen to this indie media radio show, you can be better informed than what the spoon-fed corporate media, like our all-hate AM radio station here in town, is trying to sell you. We try to shine a spotlight of truth in these Orwellian times.
This evening we bring you George Orwell's 1984, published 1949. Except the posters that were plastered everywhere. The black mustachioed face gazed down from every commanding corner. There was one on the house front immediately opposite. "Big Brother is watching you," the caption said, while the dark eyes looked deep into Winston's
home. There are such things as roving wiretaps. Now, by the way, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretap, a wiretap requires a court order. Nothing has changed, by the way. When we're talking about chasing down terrorists, we're talking about getting a court order before we do so.
Any sound that Winston made, above the level of a very low whisper, would be picked up by it. Moreover, so long as he remained within the field of vision which the metal plaque commanded, he could be seen as well as heard.
This is a highly classified program that is crucial to our national security. Its purpose is to detect and prevent terrorist attacks against the United States, our friends and allies. Yesterday, the existence of this secret program was revealed in media reports after being improperly provided to news organizations.
No way of knowing whether or not you were being watched at any given moment. How often or on what system the thought police plugged in on any individual wire was guesswork. It was even conceivable that they watched everybody all the time.
And the unauthorized disclosure of this effort damages our national security and puts our citizens at risk.
From where Winston stood, it was possible to read, picked out on his white face in elegant lettering, the three slogans of the party. War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
And when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
And when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
That when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength. This has been The Angry Indian, and you have been listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio's reading of 1984 by George Orwell. Thank you for listening.
Many of these reports you're about to hear are produced on other low-power community radio stations like this one you're listening to now, WNRB. Like our 93.3 WNRB shows, you can find many of these on the web by clicking on their web stream link to the station link. This station link can be found at our wnrb.blogspot.com. So again, if you want to listen to us on the net, check out wnrb.blogspot.com for all our WNRB programming. And many of these shows you're about to hear can be found archived on the web as well. I primarily pull from two sites for these MP3 formatted shows. One is at radioforall.net. If you look up this site, you must use the number 4, not spell out 4. So that's radio, the number 4, net, radioforall.net. The other site I often use is off the main page of the indymedia.org website. Both the radioforall.net and the indymedia.org locations can be found many MP3 shows similar to the ones you are hearing today. I highly encourage you to check them out and discover the truth behind the lies corporate news outlets like to shove down our throats.
War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
If you don't want to be lapping dogs to the likes of the misogynist Rush or the racist Savage, or you just want an alternative to the daily grind of our corporate lapdogs, quote, media, unquote, then listen to the Mike Cannon Show each Monday, which runs from 2 to 6 p.m. And again, these great sites for MP3 alternative news information programs can be found at radioforall.net and indymedia.org. Coming up next, as in most weeks, this week I bring you the alternative to the Sunday morning yak shows you hear on Main Street television.
War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
And bring you the alternative reporting from the folks at Eat the State out of Seattle, Washington. So again, here's a 20-minute news segment of alternative news at Eat the State out of Seattle, Washington. As always, thanks for tuning in to this Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show for Central Wisconsin.
It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Tons to cover.
Well, that's a surprise, yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah, we try from week to week. One of these weeks, we're just going to have, you know, like a couple of items from Washington, D.C., and the rest of it will all be good news of really cool things that people are doing locally, and people will think they found the wrong program.
I'm going to say, I don't have a laugh track ready for that one.
Yeah.
All right. The University of Washington Board of Regents has put their foot down.
Yeah, they voted on Thursday in a strong human rights stand that actually is better than not taking the stand, I suppose, to divest themselves of all companies that they have money invested in that do business with the government of the country of Sudan because of the extensive human rights violations in Darfur and many other places in that long-running civil war. Well, it's a very good and very noble stand. Obviously, the amount of money that the University of Washington has invested in companies that do business in the country of Sudan is not very large. But as it turns out, there is one company that does do business in Sudan that UW has money in. That is Royal Dutch Shell. So we'll see if UW acts on this, and hopefully student groups will follow up and monitor that and pay attention to whether they actually do it. But in the meantime, you know, the next time you fill up your gas tank, remember that Royal Dutch Shell is in the Sudan, as well as many other unsavory places. And maybe when you see that Shell sign on the side of the highway, you should just keep on going a little bit. You know, maybe look for a Citgo, which is owned by the country of Venezuela, which their state oil company, which actually puts a lot of their oil profits into money for the poor. Imagine that. So it's a little bit different.
Yeah. All right. And the state Supreme Court has weighed in, or is weighing in, with Strange Bedfellows, KVI, and the ACLU.
Yeah, they actually heard a case this week involving KVI Radio, the conservative talk AM station in Seattle, and the ACLU, usually reviled by conservatives, has gone to bat for KVI in this case, and for its talk show hosts, John Carlson and Kirby Wilbur. They have been sued because of their advocacy on the air and their organizing efforts on the air for the initiative last year that would have repealed the gas death tax. It had a lot of initial momentum. It got a lot of signatures quickly, got on the ballot, and then ultimately failed. But one of the ways it got signatures very, very quickly was that Carlson and Wilbur were not only promoting it on the air, they were telling listeners where to go to get petitions. They were using the airwaves to essentially to organize. And what the complaint filed with the state election folks claimed was that that was an in-kind donation, and that when broadcast stations, when media take stances on initiatives like that or ballot measures, that they should be required to report in-kind donations. Well, this opens up a whole can of worms, for any publication or radio station, and I guess Eat the State would be one of them, that actually takes stances and urges action of its audience on ballot measures. So it's kind of an important case, especially if the court rules in favor of the complainants and broadens the scope of it. It could be it could really change how political reporting happens in the state of Washington.
All right, and finally, the U.S. Supreme Court is weighing in or going to potentially weigh in on schools?
Yeah, this actually is a really dangerous case that people need to pay attention to. It comes from the city of Seattle. In fact, the Seattle School District, and it's going to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. They accepted the case this week. It's a major, major test case, and the issue in this case was the use of the Seattle School District of race as a tie-breaking factor, one of several tie-breaking factors, in determining when there were too many students who wanted the same schools as part of the school assignment system that the district had until a few years ago when this court challenge came up and the district put that particular system in abeyance until they got a clear court ruling on it. What may well happen, the last time in an affirmative action case came before the Supreme Court, John Roberts and Samuel Alito were not on the court, and the court, with Sandra Day O'Connor being the swing vote, gave this sort of nuanced half one side, half the other ruling that allowed race to continue to be used as a tie-breaking factor. That may not hold this time. This case from Seattle may in fact open the door to what would effectively be the resegregation of public schools in the United States. It's a very, very worrisome case. Pay attention to it.
All right. Well, moving to national, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is a Sergio Leone film, but
yes,
it also describes what some of the decisions Congress made this week.
Yeah, Congress was really busy this week, and I'll just run through them briefly. Some of them will be familiar for folks, some of them won't. A couple of issues in which Congress was bad this week, both of which I think there have been, such alarmist emails floating around for the last 10 years that people aren't taking these issues very seriously, and they should. One of them involved the issue of net neutrality, that is the proposal by big telecommunications companies to allow big companies that pay big users that pay a higher fee, the AOLs and Googles and Yahoos and so forth, to have their websites be accessed quickly by customers, and the small fry, the little blogs, the alternative websites that give you different kinds of news, people with dissenting opinion, will load very slowly, or maybe they won't even load at all if your internet service provider doesn't like what they have to say. That is making its way through Congress. It is a very real threat. An effort to attach an amendment to a bill that would have killed it failed this week in the House by a 269 to 152 vote. That's a major margin. All Republicans and some Democrats voted against it. Keep an eye on that. Also, we had NPR and PBS potentially taking a major hit in their funding. That passed the House Appropriations Committee this week. It'll go to the full House. It'll go to the Senate. The House Appropriations Committee voting to cut $115 million from public broadcasting's 2007 budget. That's 25% of their budget. And that again would take effect in September 2006, in just a few months. So, a major threat to the budget of really for a lot of people, particularly in more rural parts of the country. It's their really only broadcast source of any kind of meaningful news and information in this country, and it would be a terrible thing to lose. We also had Tom DeLay going out in flames this week. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute, but Arlen Specter Unfortunately, deciding that the Senate Judiciary Committee is not going to be able to question phone company executives on the NSA database scandal. That's because Dick Cheney informed Specter that the executives would be prohibited on national security grounds from answering any of his questions. Specter's committee is also interested in having the FBI come and testify on why the FBI wants 50 years of Jack Anderson's papers, the investigative journalist who died a few years ago. And we had also Dick Cheney and his office announcing that they now consider themselves exempt from the yearly requirement to report how Cheney's office uses its power to classify secret information. So they're keeping secret what they keep secret. It's really kind of frightening and secretive. On the good side, we talked about Tom DeLay going down in flames. Not only did he go out swinging, saying a few quite impolitic and rather embarrassing things, but the day before he did that, it was revealed that his wife, Christine DeLay, who has already had a spotlight shine on her for getting $115,000 in particularly unwarranted salary from a guy named Edwin Buckham, who is an associate of Jack Abramoff's, who's already pleaded guilty, a former chief of staff of DeLay. But it turns out that Buckham was also setting up a retirement account for Christine DeLay and putting money into it. It brings the total amount of money that Buckham and Abramoff funneled into Tom DeLay via his wife to over $500,000 for this paragon of Republican virtue. We also had in the category of good news, the Senate voting down the constitutional amendment for that would prohibit gay marriage, and they also voted down the estate tax. That failed as well, and there was some question as to whether Maria Cantwell would vote yay or nay, and she wound up voting nay, to her credit. So that's good news.
I know the estate tax in Washington is coming up as an issue. Do you think that was in response to that, or that was just something that was running in parallel?
The
two different efforts, you know.
Yeah, it's such a tricky thing for Washington State because, of course, the state's biggest newspaper, that's like their major political campaign. That's what Frank Bluthen cares about. And so there's a lot of pressure on elected politicians in Washington State to bend that way. And Cantwell did not, to her credit. So it's good for her.
All right. Jumping back to national, there were numerous primaries this week.
Yeah, and some bad news, some good news. Francine Busby lost in her bid as a Democrat to replace Duke Cunningham in California's 50th district. That's a heavily Republican district, and she only lost by 49-45%, so which is way better than a Democrat has done there probably in forever. So that actually wasn't nearly as bad as it sounds. Unfortunately, there was also a very good initiative that failed in California that would have taxed the rich to pay for a universal preschool program, which would have been very good. However, also in California, Humboldt County passed a very interesting and quite possibly revolutionary initiative, something called Measure T. What it does is prohibit corporations from outside the county from donating to political campaigns and ballot measures inside the county. In other words, what it does basically is strip the citizenship rights of corporations who have in the past been allowed by courts because they have the rights of individuals to have the rights as campaign donors of individuals, meaning that they can donate anywhere they want. Humboldt County is not going to allow that, and we'll see where that goes in the courts, but it's definitely a good thing for them. We also had a guy named John Tester, real progressive in Montana, win against a centrist Democrat in the Democratic primary there. He goes on to take Senator Conrad Burns, who's a very embattled incumbent Republican senator in Montana because of his associations with Jack Abramoff. So a potential there to get a progressive Democrat into office from the state of Montana, of all places. And we talked last week about Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s expose on what happened in 2004 in the state of Ohio and the role of Secretary of State Kim Blackwell, now running for governor. Mr. Blackwell was at it again this week, promulgating rules that makes it very, very difficult, in fact, quite possibly felonious for people to register new voters in the state of Ohio, where the new voter registrations are running heavily Democratic, particularly in urban areas. So people are up in arms about that. It's basically Blackwell is trying to deny the vote to a great many people by suppressing voter turnout in 2006.
All right, and then in Congress or the Senate, Murtha, who aspires to be to move to a leadership position.
Yeah, that's in the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. Jack Murtha, the anti-war critic from Ohio, announced that he wants to become the new majority leader if the Democrats take back the Senate the House in November. That would mean Nancy Pelosi would become Speaker of the House. The number two position would be the House Majority Leader, the leader of the Democrats, and that's what Murtha wants. It would be an open seat right now. His main competition is Steny Hoyer, who's very much a centrist DLC-type Democrat that Murtha has clashed quite a bit with in the past, especially on Iraq.
Well, you just mentioned Iraq, and let's jump to international. Met plenty of developments there, as there are every week.
Yeah, well, the big news, of course, was the killing of Zarqawi, which unfortunately is getting a lot of really appalling media attention in this country, because the whole Bush administration spin of this being a major victory and a turning point, what does this make it about turning point or turning the corner number 10 or so, it's not going to change anything on the ground in Iraq. Yeah, Zarqawi was a nasty dude. He killed a lot of people who didn't deserve to be killed. Of course, you could say the same thing about George Bush, I suppose. But you know, in this case, nobody aside from a few jihadists is really going to mourn his death. But number one, there's plenty more jihadists where he came from, and you know, in many ways, the Bush administration invented him. They originally invented him as the fictitious link between Al Qaeda and Saddam Hussein in 2003. He used that as his street cred to actually recruit jihadists to his cause, and he became what they had already insisted he was. But with him gone, somebody else will step in to fill the breach. There's plenty of candidates, and we just don't know what the name is yet, but we'll find it out soon. That being said, the jihadist movement is a very, very small part of the insurgency in Iraq. It's mostly nationalists. That being said, the violence in Iraq right now is not primarily coming from attacks on American and British troops. It's primarily coming from sectarian strife from the civil war that Bush's folly has launched. And for people who doubt that, I recommend a very good article that came out earlier this week on Tuesday by Patrick Coburn that appeared in Encounter Punch. It's called something... something like Bloodbath Beyond the Green Zone, and what it talks about is the reality on the ground in rural Iraq, places especially outside Baghdad that aren't being reported, where the violence is almost all due to death squads and assassinations by competing Shiite and Sunni groups. It makes for very grim reading, and really ought to disabuse anybody of the notion that the assassination of Zarqawi is going to change anything on the ground in Iraq.
Patrick Coburn being one of the few reporters, a handful of reporters in Iraq that actually leaves the Baghdad hotel to actually do reporting.
Yeah, and he's very experienced in the region and in Iraq, and you know, knows the language and the people and has a lot of contacts, and he does get around, and his reporting is really quite invaluable. At the same time, we had a couple of other interesting developments. We had one of the biggest, in fact, Sunni party in Iraq called the Iraqi Islamic Party, saying that you know, in addition to Haditha, in addition to Ishaqi, which we talked about last week, that there had also been some 29 Iraqi civilians that had been murdered in May by the United States, and they in various places, in small, you know, numbers, groups, a few here, a few there, had all been killed universally by American airstrikes. But that accusation Nation did not get any press whatsoever in the United States, of course. And then we also had the first officer in the U.S. military, a person named Lieutenant Aram Watada, who refused to deploy to Iraq. Mr. Watada is getting a lot of national attention for this refusal, and he happens to have been stationed in and come from Fort Lewis right here in the state of Washington. So we can be proud of him for that.
All right, moving along, Afghanistan.
Yeah, interesting development there this week. We had 23 Afghans released from Bagram, the Air Force base north of Kabul, where there's a pretty notorious prison. There's about 500 Afghans that have been held in detention, indefinitely, without trial, without charges, without access to lawyers or human rights monitors, etc. And those Afghans turned around and started talking to the media and were complaining of maltreatment at the hands of the Americans at a new prison that had been built there. So, keep an eye on that, because the mistreatment of prisoners in Iraq and Afghanistan is apparently continuing.
And Iran.
Yeah, we had a development today, in fact, Iran time anyway. The foreign minister there saying that Iran will make a counteroffer to the United States offer to negotiate that came out of the Bush administration about 7-10 days ago. So there's some movement on that, and these two governments full of hardliners may actually try and sit down and negotiate. What a concept.
All right. And moving along, the Pentagon looks like it wants to make its manuals a little bit lighter, at least when it comes to Geneva Conventions.
Yeah, several human rights things this week. The Pentagon announced a proposal, which is getting some flack from the State Department and Congress, that it wants to omit from its new Army Field Manual on interrogation the Geneva Convention's ban on humiliating and degrading treatment of prisoners. There's going to be no mention in the new manual that that's a bad thing, so that people can go right ahead and do their humiliating and degrading treatment, even though it violates the Geneva Conventions. We also had at Guantanamo the revelation that there are now it's now up to 89 hunger strikers out of the 500 or so prisoners that are remaining. That's up from three only a few weeks ago. So apparently, in response to the so-called prisoner riot there a few weeks ago and the fallout from that, there have been a number of hunger strikes launched that people aren't really hearing about. And then finally, the Council of Europe issued a pretty damning report on CIA rendition this week. What they did is they went through and got flight plans from various air traffic control towers of flights that they track all over the world. And what they came up with was what they called a spider web, basically, of CIA routes of rendition flights, including they came to the conclusion that there are at least two secret bases in Eastern Europe, one in Poland and one in Romania, but they're spread all over the world. And this is something that the CIA is doing with the knowledge and the complicity of governments not only in Europe, but, again, all over the world.
All right. And quickly, South Korea, U.S. looking at making some trade arrangements there?
Yeah, this is a scary one that didn't get any attention this week, but again, we should pay attention. Bush administration wants to launch a new NAFTA-style agreement, this one with South Korea, and there's enormous opposition to that. If you recall at the last WTO meetings in Hong Kong, it was the farmers and activists from South Korea that raised the most havoc there in protest, and you can be sure that in South Korea there will be a lot of opposition to this proposed free trade agreement. Whether it gets any attention in the United States, well, that's for us to work on.
All right, and quickly, email from a listener, Nicholas Hart, regarding Jack Murtha. Murtha is not anti-war. He wants to redeploy troops in the region around Iraq and increase the use of bombing against the people of Iraq. In short, he wants to rescue U.S. imperialism in the Middle East, not end U.S. intervention there.
I basically agree. He is anti the war as it is now being fought. He has said that he wants to move troops over the horizon and get them out of Iraq, which actually would be a vast improvement over where they are now. But he does want to deploy them elsewhere in the Middle East and maintain hegemony in the region. That's absolutely true. At the same time, he's been intensely critical of how the Bush administration has prosecuted the war, and it is thought that he speaks for a lot of the top brass in the Pentagon when he does that. So, fair point. Good point.
All right. Events.
Yeah, the big one, of course, this week is that President Bush is coming to Medina on Friday morning to have a nice fundraising event on behalf of Representative Dave Reichert, the freshman congressman running for re-election and claiming that he is a moderate and not very close to the Bush administration. Well, he's got a spirited challenge from Darcy Berner on his hands. Looks like it'll be a close election. So who does he turn to? That guy that he doesn't really have very much in common with, President Bush, who very few congresspeople are even asking for help right now because Bush is so low in the polls. But Reichert has not really been publicizing this visit because he doesn't necessarily want the association with Bush because he's so bad in the polls, but he does want the money from Bush's big roller supporters. So that's what this visit is all about. There will be a protest of it. There's at least one that has been called for 8:30 with a march as close as they can get to Medina. I'm sure there will be other people just lining the route of 520 and the exit and trying to get Bush's attention one way or the other as things get organized this week.
Talking once again, as we do every week, with John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is a free publication that comes out every couple of weeks. You can find it at bookstores and cafes and the King County Library System and all the other places where you find free periodicals around town. We are also on the web, although much to our annoyance and frustration, the technical problems we've been having with our blog over the last month, 6 weeks, have culminated this week in the whole thing, the whole site that and server that it's based on being down, so our apologies for that. But the main site is still up and running. It has the current issue. It has all our back issues. It's at www.eatthestate.org.
And now, the man who invented the 21st century, Mike Cannon.
That was Eat the State out of Seattle, Washington. That's what we do here each week at the Mike Cannon Show. We bring our alternative voices from around the country and the world. Voices you hear nowhere else in central Wisconsin, except every Monday from 2 to 6 on this WNRB Wausau Community Radio Station. Up next, we're going to stay with Gov Parrish from Meet the State for a fast four-minute piece. He'll talk about how the Bush administration is cutting blue states' anti-terrorism money and giving it to red states and swing states. Nothing like trying to buy an election. Here's that report, and as always, thanks for listening to this indie media radio program, The Mike Cannon Show.
Swing states can never be too safe. This is Jav Parrish. Last week, the Department of Homeland Security released its list of $740 million in counterterrorism grant fund awards for 2006, divided among 46 U.S. metropolitan areas. And right there on the list of top terror targets is Kansas City, with a whopping $9.2 million in money intended to thwart al-Qaeda. It's even more than Kansas City's much larger cross-state city, St. Louis, with its Gateway Arch and vastly superior baseball team. Not quite as much as Jacksonville, Florida, at $9.3 million, but it's still lots more than Seattle, which only gets $9,150,000 to stop terrorist attacks this year, $2.7 million less than in 2005. They must have figured out that nobody really hangs out around the Space Needle anyway. In fact, a lot of cities will be getting more anti-terrorism money than Seattle in 2006. Ready? New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Washington, Newark, San Francisco, Philadelphia, Atlanta, Detroit, Boston, Houston, Miami, Dallas, Anaheim, Fort Lauderdale, Baltimore, Orlando, Portland, Jacksonville, Kansas City, and St. Louis, to be exact. Fort Lauderdale. Who even knew Fort Lauderdale had any national icons or national monuments worth protecting? Those are two of the key criteria used by those sage Homeland Security folks. And to think al-Qaeda took airplane lessons down there and didn't even notice. Of course, Fort Lauderdale's in good company. According to the 100 or so government and law enforcement officials from around the country whose peer review committee decided on the anti-terror awards, New York City doesn't have any national icons or monuments either. And neither does Washington, D.C. Osama apparently wasted some perfectly good box cutters. If only he'd known. Predictably, local officials and congressional representatives from both the New York and D.C. areas are furious. New York's funding got cut by a staggering 40% this year. And the overall funding to protect America's urban areas from terrorist attacks in 2006 was cut by $125 million, from $865 million to $740 million. I guess George Bush really doesn't think much about bin Laden that much anymore. Or maybe, just maybe, the problem is that only cities located in states where Republicans are struggling to hang on to power in the 2006 elections did really, really well in the Department of Homeland's grant allocation process. Louisville, Omaha, Milwaukee, Charlotte, Tampa, and St. Louis all got nice, hefty increases this year. Swing states, every one of them. $8.5 million for Louisville? $8.8 million for the noted terrorist target of Milwaukee? Tampa got $8.8 million, and four other cities in Florida got even more. The one exception was Ohio, where no one city even got $5 million, but according to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the Republicans have Ohio pretty well sewn up anyway. But just look at the blue cities. Seattle, D.C., New York, the entire San Francisco area, all 6 million residents, somehow got less than Newark. Maybe the Golden Gate Bridge isn't considered a national icon anymore. Undoubtedly, Al-Qaeda was prepared for all this, as planned its next terror attack accordingly. They know now that our defenses are strongest in the swing states, not the big cities where terrorists might, you know, inflict some real damage. Osama knows the score. Having a government hand out vast sums of money in a way that serves the personal political interests of its rulers is something they're real familiar with in the Middle East. It's exactly how all those American-sponsored dictatorships work. Now, if only Americans could wrap our minds around the idea that our government might cynically manipulate the vast sums of money being handed out around the global war on terror. Gee, you think? From KBCS, for the Pacifica Network, this is Jav Parrish.
And now, the man your mother warned you about, Mike Cannon.
Up next, a few short pieces out of Palestine. You know, each week media outlets like the supposed liberal media NPR have a lot of news produced for Israel propaganda. The weekly show, Voices of Israel radio program, runs every night on our local NPR station around midnight, and it is the first international news program from around the world you get to hear on that NPR station. However, you never get to hear any alternative to Voice of Israel, like why don't we hear some reports from Occupied Palestine perspective? Well, you won't get any of that except right here on this Indie Media Radio program. So each week I try to dedicate a couple of short segments of this program to news from Palestine's point of view. Here is this week's offering, a few short reports about the atrocities that continue to happen in occupied Palestine.
Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, a Thursday, June 8, 2006. Army invades Kafr Ra'i and Fahima villages west of Jenin. Army arrests one resident from Tolkaram and invades Balata al-Balad village near Nablus, also arresting one. The Israeli army hands out military orders to demolish four houses in Al-Qahda village near Bethlehem. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Israeli army invaded the villages of Kafr Ra'i and Fahima west of the West Bank city of Jenin Thursday morning. In Fahima, army jeeps entered the village from several directions and installed a military checkpoint at the entrance of the village. Meanwhile, another army unit stormed Kafr Ra'i village, searched several homes and installed a portable checkpoint at the village's Ala Road east of the village, local sources reported. The Israeli army arrested one resident from the West Bank city of Tolkaram refugee camp Thursday at dawn. Osama Al-Jumi, 22, was arrested when the Israeli army invaded the refugee camp, surrounded his house, searching it before arresting him and taking him to an unknown location, eyewitnesses reported. In a separate incident, the army invaded the nearby Saida village north of the city and searched several homes. No arrests were made, local sources reported. The Israeli troops have arrested one resident from Balata al-Balad village east of the West Bank city of Nablus Thursday at dawn. Troops stormed the village and searched several homes before arresting Mohammed Dawakat, local sources reported. According to resident, troops invaded the homes of the resident and shot randomly live rounds inside houses, causing a state of panic amongst the children. The Israeli army has invaded the West Bank city of Nablus and Balata and Ain Mal'a'i refugee camps in the city on Thursday morning. Troops stormed the city and the two refugee camps. Clashes erupted in several areas of the city, but no injuries were reported, local sources said. Soldiers shot randomly at residents' homes and cars and conducted a wide-scale search campaign in the city and the two refugee camps. No arrests were reported, local sources said. The West Bank city of Nablus is witnessing daily invasions, and this invasive Israeli army operation has been going on for several months, during which scores of residents have been arrested, injured and killed. Israeli forces have beaten and arrested one resident from the West Bank city of Hebron this Thursday morning. Yahiha Martasib, 24, was attacked and arrested when troops invaded his family home in the Dwerben area of the city. The soldiers gave no reason for the arrest or the attack, the family reported. Israeli civil administration officers and soldiers invaded the village of Al-Khada, south of the West Bank city of Bethlehem, and handed out military orders to demolish several houses there Thursday at dawn. One house is located near the main road connecting Al-Khada to the nearby village of Wadi Rahal, and the three other homes under threat belong to Sami Salah and his two brothers, local sources reported. The army gave the residents until the 19th of June to make legal objections at the civil administration headquarters at the nearby illegal settlement of Beit Il. The Israeli army arrested one resident from the village of Itna near the West Bank city of Hebron on Thursday. The man, whose name remains unknown, was driving his car when soldiers stopped him at the village entrance, exploded his car and then arrested him. The reason for the arrest and his location are still unknown. One resident injured from Sarif town west of the West Bank city of Hebron after being attacked by right-wing Israeli settlers on Thursday. Mohammed Ignimat was injured when a group of Israeli settlers attacked him on his way home. Ignimat was moved to a nearby hospital in the city where his injuries are described as severe, medical sources reported. And that's just some of the news today in Palestine. For constant updates, check out the International Middle East Media Center website, www.imemc.org. As always, thanks for joining us. From Occupied Bethlehem, this is Palestine Today, brought to you by Penny Quinton and Ghassan Benoura.
This is a summary of Israeli war crimes committed in Palestine for the week ending 7 June 2006. Israeli occupation forces escalate attacks on Palestinian civilians and property in occupied Palestine. Five Palestinians were killed by Israeli occupation forces in the Gaza Strip. Two of the victims were extrajudicially assassinated by the Israeli occupation force. 29 Palestinian civilians, including 9 children and a woman, were wounded by Israeli gunfire. Israeli occupation forces have continued to shell Palestinian areas in the northern Gaza Strip, wounding a number of civilians and damaging civilian property. Israeli occupation forces conducted 42 incursions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank, particularly Nablus, and one incursion into the Gaza Strip. 55 Palestinian civilians, including a child, were arrested by Israeli occupation forces this past week. A home was transformed by Israeli occupation forces into a military site. Israeli occupation forces raided a hospital in Nablus and arrested a patient from the intensive care unit. Israeli occupation forces have also continued to impose a total siege in occupied Palestine. They've continued to close border crossings of the Gaza Strip. The north of the West Bank has been separated from its south, and Israeli occupation forces arrested two Palestinian civilians, including a child, at checkpoints in the West Bank. Israeli occupation forces have continued to construct the apartheid wall in the West Bank and have raised areas of agricultural land near Shavi Sharom settlement in the north of the West Bank. and Israeli occupation forces have confiscated in this past week 1,495 dunams of land in the Kalkilia and Tulkarm areas of the West Bank. Finally, Israeli settlers have continued to attack Palestinian civilians and property in occupied Palestine. Seven civilian facilities were demolished by Israeli occupation forces, and four Palestinian civilians, including a child and a woman, were injured by attacks launched by Israeli settlers. For a more complete description of these gross human rights violations and war crimes, you can go to www.pchrgaza.org.
You are listening to a radio. Because of the time it takes for radio to travel to Earth from distant sources, radio astronomers are able to see the universe as it appeared more than 10 billion years ago. The artificial radio broadcast you are listening to now portrays the universe as it was just 1 second ago. Stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson. The tens of millions of dollars spent by the phone and cable companies to begin the process of privatizing the Internet has so far been money well spent, as the process got underway in the House of Representatives on the evening of June 8th. Majorities voted to defeat amendments to a larger telecom reform bill that would have preserved the principle of network neutrality. Democrat Ed Markey of Massachusetts, who led the failed campaign to save Internet freedom in the House, knew the odds were not in his favor from the outset.
We want to have a debate on net neutrality. All the Republicans are willing to give to the proponents of net neutrality the central constitutional protection built into the Internet for the last 20 years is 10 minutes. That is a disgrace.
The 20-minute debate, featuring 10 minutes for each side, was feisty. Opponents of the creation of Internet speech stratified by your ability to pay put up a valiant fight, but they were bum-rushed by lawmakers well-marinated in telco and cable cash and not afraid to twist the facts of the debate to the point of outright lies, resulting in a well-oiled choir all singing out of the same phone books and cable guides. Like the bill's main sponsor, Joe Barton, Republican from Texas, who denied the very essence of the dispute.
We're debating a term of net neutrality that didn't exist 9 months ago.
New Jersey Republican Mike Ferguson cribbed from the still proliferating AstroTurf groups that have been set up to muddy the issue.
Congress's hands-off policy has allowed the World Wide Web to prosper by having the market pick winners and losers.
Texas Republican Lamar Smith provided the refrain,
"Reject government regulation of the Internet,"
which was echoed by Nebraska Republican Lee Terry.
"Let's not regulate the Internet today."
Tennessee Republican Marsha Blackburn set the hype machine to overdrive.
"The next thing is going to be having a Secretary of Internet Access. I don't believe that's somewhere we want to go."
Joined by Texas Democrat Gene Green.
"Higher prices for the consumers, while large Internet content providers get a free ride."
And fellow Texas Democrat Charlie Gonzalez, who actually accused the supporters of Internet freedom of ganging up on the poor, mistreated telcos and cable providers.
"It is driven by a hostility against one particular business entity that is involved and is a stakeholder in the Internet. It is unfair when this body takes sides."
And then there was Illinois Democrat Bobby Rush, who a few years back secured a $1 million donation from the SBC Foundation for a technology center to be built in his name in his Chicago area district. A co-sponsor of the omnibus telecom reform bill, Rush sung the praises of non-existent protections to network neutrality and argued against preservation of the principle.
"This is a good bill. This is a marvelous bill. This is a bill that's worthwhile."
Later in the debate, Rush was called upon again to defend the drive to do away with free speech online.
"This is a good bill. This is a great bill. This bill will go a lot, will do a lot, go a long way."
While the vote in the House is history, California Democrat Zoe Lofgren does not believe the fight is anywhere near over.
"When the public finds out what we are doing to their Internet, the dome is going to collapse with the uproar that creates."
According to a cursory review of the campaign finance information archived at the nonpartisan opensecrets.org, all of those quoted here have collectively raked in more than $615,000 in direct political donations and contributions to their reelection funds from just the major phone and cable companies and the trade associations that do their heavy lifting in Washington. This just counts the money that's exchanged hands so far in the 2005 and 2006 election cycle alone and does not count additional contributions made to individual leadership political action committees, those slush funds politicians use to spread cash around among friends. Of the windfall we added up on a whim, 84% of it went to those who opposed network neutrality. Not bad for a night's work. Keep in mind, every representative is up for re-election in November. In the Senate, the principle of network neutrality will be the subject of another Senate Commerce Committee hearing later this month, and there's already strong bipartisan support there for a piece of legislation called the Internet Freedom Preservation Act, which may now be the last hope to keep the net as we know it. Visit SaveTheInternet.com to learn much more about this upcoming battle. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
And now, the man your mother warned you about, Mike Cannon.
Coming up next, the short 3-minute piece the Mike Cannon Show produces nationally called This Week's Iraq Body Count. Then taking us to the top of the hour, we'll bring you a little in-the-news report from Cottage Grove, Oregon. This is more of the examples of what you'll find here each week on the Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. Thanks for listening.
Choice is an illusion created between those with power and those without.
What do all men with power want? More power.
Now they knew who was master and leader. Sheep, thought I.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Remorse for what? You people have done everything in the world to me. Doesn't that give me equal right? I can do anything I want to you people at any time I want to, because that's what you've done to me. If you spit in my face and smack me in the mouth and throw me in solitary confinement for nothing, what do you think's going to happen when I get out of here? Well, I haven't done enough. I might be ashamed of that for not doing enough. For not doing enough. For not being more perceptive. For not being aware enough. For not understanding. For being stupid. Maybe I should have killed 400 or 500 people. Then I would have felt better. Then I felt like I really offered society something. I can. But I find more real in the world that I'm in than I do the tinsel. And the real world is the one I have to deal with every day. Believe me, if I started murdering people, they could not be left.
Chemical weapons threat. Terrorists, dangerous, die. In turn, murders.
There are some who feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on.
As of Monday, June 12, 2006, 2,486 United States military personnel had died in Iraq since the start of the invasion. 18,254 United States military personnel had been wounded, over 6,000 of which had suffered grievous injuries such as amputations. 214 other coalition forces had also been killed.
Join us or die.
According to the British medical journal Lancet, over 100,000 Iraqi civilians had died since the start of the invasion.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
What do you see when you're in the dark and the demons come?
Sit back, relax, breathe in. Slowly, there you go. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
This is in the news for June 7th, 2006. I'm Scott Berguin from KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. First up today from the New Standard News at newstandardnews.net, written by Carrie Leiterson, chlorine plants hidden culprits in mercury contamination. This is dated June 6th. Environmental groups have set their sights on a little-known target, a handful of chlorine plants that may be releasing more mercury than all of the nation's 500 coal-burning plants combined. Though most of the chlorine industry has switched to mercury-free technology, a few remaining chlor-alkali plants use a century-old method to produce chlorine by pumping salt water through mercury cells. According to a 2005 analysis of Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, data by the environmental group Oceana, the 9 chloralkali plants in operation in 2000 reported purchasing and ostensibly using 79 tons of mercury and releasing 14 tons. The other 65 tons could not be accounted for. The industry and the EPA have speculated that the lost mercury may be caught in the infrastructure inside the facilities, but EPA analysis of contamination at closed plants have not found nearly enough to account for the discrepancy between the mercury consumption and emission. Jackie Savitz, director of the Stop Seafood Contamination Campaign of Oceana, said, quote, "It may be going out in the air. It may be going out in waste material that isn't accounted for. They would like to say it's hiding in the pipes, but they haven't really been able to prove that," end quote. Since Oceana's analysis of 9 plants, one is shut down, another has announced imminent closure, and still another has said it will convert to the newer, cleaner technology at a cost of $90 million. Oceana and the Natural Resources Defense Council are pushing the chlorine industry and the EPA to force the remaining plants to account for the undocumented mercury and to switch to mercury-free technology used by 90% of the industry under a provision of the Clean Air Act that mandates companies use the best pollution control technology available in their industry. But in a final rule published in 2003, the EPA classified the mercury cell plants as a separate industry and exempted them from having to meet the standards set by the rest of the chlorine plants. In 2004, the Sierra Club and the NRDC petitioned the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. to review the rule and also petitioned the EPA to reconsider. The EPA granted their petition for reconsideration, and a decision on the rule is currently still pending. With enforcement from the EPA stalled for the past year, Oceana has been trying to directly pressure the companies to change their technology to ask the Chlorine Institute only to allow mercury-free members. Oceana has organized demonstrations outside the plants and delivered cans of tuna to the Chlorine Institute president during its annual meeting in Chicago in April. Commercially canned tuna nationwide has been found to have high levels of mercury. Calls to the companies that run the plants, Olin Corporation, Ashta or A-S-H-T-A Chemicals, ERCO, Pioneer Chlor Alkali, and PPG were not returned. The Chlorine Institute trade group, which also could not be reached for this story, has pointed out that the mercury cell plants have reduced their stated mercury emissions in recent years. But Savitz said the decrease in reported emissions does not make up for refusing to use updated technology that could curb pollution dramatically. She said, quote, "This technology is completely unnecessary," unquote. There's more on this at newstandardnews.net. Again, that's written by Carrie Leiterson. Next up, from the Environmental News Service at ens-newswire.com. U.S. government sued for allowing imports of Peruvian mahogany. This is dated June 6th. Doubly illegal, mahogany from the Peruvian Amazon is being imported into the United States for the deluxe furniture under the noses of 3 federal agencies, according to a lawsuit filed today by 2 Peruvian indigenous groups and the Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC, a U.S. conservation organization. The suit was filed in the U.S. Court of International Trade in New York City. Nearly all of Peru's mahogany exports are logged illegally, the group say. Importing it into the United States is illegal because it violates the U.S. Endangered Species Act and a major international treaty, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, the lawsuit charges. More than 80% of illegally logged Peruvian mahogany ends up in the United States. Ari Hershowitz, NRDC's Latin American BioGems Project Director, said, quote, "Millions of dollars worth of Peruvian mahogany enters U.S. ports every year in violation of U.S. and international law. While U.S. border control agencies look the other way, the rainforests and the communities that depend on them to survive are being plundered," end quote. Named as defendants in the lawsuit are the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of the Interior, the Department of Agriculture, and 3 U.S. importers, Bozovich Timber Products of Evergreen, Alabama, T. Baird International Corporation of King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, and TBM Hardwoods of Hanover, Pennsylvania. Logging in the Amazon threatens native communities, wildlife, and survival of the mahogany species itself, the NRDC says. At the current pace, experts predict that mahogany will be commercially extinct within a decade. There's much more on this at ens-newswire.com. And finally today, from the hotline section of High Country News, their latest issue, written by Brett Wilkerson. This is out of Oregon. Mountain lion numbers in Oregon have exploded, according to the State Department of Fish and Wildlife. Over the next 5 years, the agency plans to reduce them by as much as 40%. In March,
The Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission approved a plan to use government hunters to reduce the current lion population to around 3,000, the estimated population in 1994, when the state's voters banned the use of dogs in sport hunting the big cats. Since then, says the department, the lion population has nearly doubled to approximately 5,000, and although it's been nearly 100 years since a lion attacked a human in Oregon, complaints about the animals have shot up. Like many other western states, Oregon has expanded its lion hunting season in recent years, but that has failed to reduce complaints or the toll of the predators' take on livestock and wildlife, says Ron Anglin, the department's Wildlife Division administrator. The recent spike in complaints is due not to an increase in lions, but to rapid human population growth in Oregon, says Lauren Nolfo Clements, a wildlife scientist with the Humane Society of the United States. Some wildlife biologists who reviewed the plan, including Professor Barry Noon of Colorado State University, say the agency's lion count is exaggerated because it relies on a scientifically dubious model and 40-year-old mortality data. Sally Mackler of the Sierra Club says, quote, "This plan is like shooting into the dark," end quote. The club is considering legal action to stop the killing, which could begin this fall. Again, that's from High Country News, written by Brett Wilkerson. This has been in the news for June 7th, 2006. I'm Scott Berguin from KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you. And now the winner of the Best Central Wisconsin Community Radio Station is voted by us computer voices, WNRB.
You've been listening to 93.3 WNRB Wausau. Real life, real learning, real radio. This is Central Wisconsin's number one community radio station. Thanks for tuning in to this indie media radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. Each week we try to bring you alternative information produced out of other not-for-profit and or community radio stations from around the country and the world. This way you can hear voices and opinions not based on what the giant megacorporations want you to hear, but real information you'll hear nowhere else in Central Wisconsin except each week on this indie media radio program. Got any gripes, suggestions, or comments about this show? You can always contact me at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. That's all one word, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Coming up next, an interview with Ultimate Fighter champion and anarchist Jeff Munson.